It is to an even more depraved administration that we turn our attention next, and this time with the help of Simon Marks, our US editor. Because the, well, I mean, I don't even know where to start anymore, Simon. It's I need to do a phone-in, and you might be able to help me with this, on stuff that people in the UK may not know about yet, but which is now becoming increasingly normalised in the United States. I think probably the people with permanent residency who are being rounded up and facing deportation, the people who I think now run the risk of being ordered to produce their papers for the offence of looking a bit Hispanic on the streets of some cities, the deployment of the military under the dishonest banner of security upon civilian streets in various cities. We could be here all day. But I want to turn you first to today's news. Regarding the birthday book put together for the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein and the furiously denied to the point of a $10 billion lawsuit against the newspaper that first made the allegation, claim that Donald Trump wrote the thing that I've been reading out all morning. How I need to ask this question, although I'm frightened of the answer. How is it landing stateside?
Well, it depends entirely with whom it is landing. I mean, look, in pre-Trump times, this would be a potential resignation matter for a former president of the United States, but it doesn't come close to being that for President Donald Trump. We knew about the existence of this birthday book weeks ago when the Wall Street Journal first reported it. The immediate response of the president was to deny to launch that lawsuit, not just against the Wall Street Journal, but a personal lawsuit for defamation against Rupert Murdoch, its owner. Now we've actually seen the document, thanks to a subpoena that led to Jeffrey Epstein's estate being required to provide that birthday book to the House of Representatives, to a House committee, and Democrats on the committee immediately put that document, appears to be completely authentic, signed by President Donald Trump. You've already described its curious contents. They've put that into the public domain, and so it is on the front pages of the vast majority of newspapers, news websites here in the United States today. But the response from the White House is to continue to deny, and to say that this is a fake, this is a smear. You know, you saw Trump loyalists taking to social media last night insisting it's not really his signature, when the Wall Street Journal itself has taken expert advice to show that they believe it absolutely is his signature. And how on earth would this document have got into that birthday book, given the large number of other prominent figures, including former President Bill Clinton, our very own Lord Mandelson, and the titans of commerce and business in New York, who made lewd and lecherous contributions to that book? So what we're going to see today, Donald Trump's going to have the press into the Oval Office. He will not only continue to deny, he will also engage in his time-honored capacity to distract. And the most important thing to understand is that when he has the press into the Oval Office today, as occurs every day now, it's not the press corps as we used to know it. It's a press corps filled by this White House with pro-Trump loyalists who now outnumber the time-honoured real journalists participating in those press appearances. So there will be pro-Trump polemicists who toss him an enormous number of softballs during the course of that appearance later today, and afford him the capacity not just to deny that this document is authentic, but to distract everybody's attention. We're going to be hearing an awful lot more about his plans to flood the streets of Chicago with National Guard troops and federal agents as a direct consequence of this image having been made public.
Because he needs to point over there, look, over there. A quick word before we return to this story, a quick word on the pretext or the rationale for flooding the streets with troops, because statistics suggest that crime has come down quite considerably in a lot of these places, and most of the people, it's a bit like being in London, actually, and reading on social media that it's a hellhole where you can't walk 100 yards with your watch on without getting hit over the head by a medicine ball. And everyone who lives here says, yeah, well we've got crime, but it's a really cool city. That he's doing the same to his own cities now.
Yes, he's doing his own two Democrat-run cities.
Crucial point.
In largely Democrat-run states.
And he's telling people that don't, sorry to interrupt, he's telling people that don't live there that these places are awful, and therefore he's the only one that can act.
Yes, cesspool. Correct. Hellhole, cesspool, wouldn't want to be seen walking the streets there because it's too dangerous. But they all, by some miracle, are Democrat-run cities. And he is overruling the elected lawmakers in those cities and in those states. We've seen the governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, calling him over the weekend a wannabe dictator, but conceding he lacks the authority to prevent Trump from federalizing the National Guard and putting them on Chicago streets. He's doing it for two reasons. Firstly, because he wants to concoct these crime wave descriptives. I mean, the crime is out of control in the United States in large measure because of the easy availability of guns. So if you want to have a serious conversation about crime, you'd be looking not only at Democrat-run cities and states, but at Republican areas as well. And you'd be asking yourself, what's the root cause of many of those crimes? And part of that is the easy availability of guns. But like Washington, D.C., Chicago's crime statistics have been falling. So what he's doing is concocting statistics of his own out of thin air in order to justify using emergency powers to put the federal to federalize the National Guard and deploy them on the streets. And his reason for doing that, James, is to test whether his authority has any limits. He loves governing through the use of emergency powers. The tariffs, they were put into practice, into force as a result of him claiming there was a trade and national security emergency that he needed to address. Crime, it's a public safety emergency. He's testing the limits of his powers, and he's laying the groundwork for the possibility, if he needs it next year, of saying to the country, you know, the crisis in this country now, the public security and safety crisis is so intense, I've got to declare a national state of emergency. I know we're supposed to be having those midterm elections in November, but right now we've got much more important issues to take care of, and we're just going to have to shelve that election campaign. That's what this is all about.
And of course, those of us who might once have greeted that analysis by saying, oh, he'll never get away with that, the people would never fall for it, have got quite a lot of evidence that the people will fall for anything, which brings us back to the Epstein stuff, where a couple of things strike me. The first is that very senior members of his administration were banging this drum with incredible enthusiasm until about 5 minutes ago, insisting that it was a smoking gun. You've got Pam Bondi saying she's got the list. Donald Trump himself campaigned on a promise to reveal all of its contents. And the same man now tries to describe it as a Democrat hoax. One of his allies claiming that he was actually an informer, which they realised pretty quickly was a pretty big mistake to make, because if he was an informer, it meant that he knew stuff that he denies happened. So the truth, as ever with Donald Trump and scandal, the truth sort of drowns, doesn't it, in a sea of distraction and alternative facts.
Yes, absolutely. The FBI informer thing is a big deal. Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
The House of Representatives.
Second in line after the Vice President, the next in line for the presidency if anything happens here, in a throwaway comment to an interviewer last week, mentioned that Donald Trump had been an FBI informant turning on Epstein. And everybody said, what? An FBI informant? And Johnson is continuing to say, well, everybody knew that. Well, no, everybody didn't know that. And precisely what did Donald Trump tell the FBI about Jeffrey Epstein? This is another example of Donald Trump wanting to have it all ways.
Yes.
He didn't know the financier, but he knew enough about the financier, he says, to oust him from Mar-a-Lago, to cancel his membership of the club down in Florida, because Jeffrey Epstein, he says, stole some members of his staff who were female and possibly underage at the time.
That's the bit. That was the second bit. You're so good at this. You knew where I was going. We've been doing this together too long, Simon. You're like a married couple. You knew exactly where I was going next. Because because that's the bit that, you know, it's only in the 40th paragraph of the story. And the claim that they fell out is somehow to be used to Donald Trump's defence. But they essentially fell out over the, quote, ownership, end quotes, of teenage girls, including Virginia Giuffre.
Exactly that. And so, look, I mean, to get back to the issue of what this means for him within the Republican Party, he's clearly got a problem with some Republican lawmakers. Nancy Mace of South Carolina, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Thomas Massey of Kentucky, they are turning on the White House over this issue. And they have been pressing for the release of all the files, as both Pam Bondi and Donald Trump himself had pledged. But whether there is sufficient opposition to him over this, actually to stand up and make those demands, or whether, as we head into a midterm election campaign, remember the entire House of Representatives up for grabs, the future of the balance of power here in Washington, D.C., very much going to be on the table next year if those elections take place in November of 2026. You know, at a certain point, those Republicans are going to have to think about themselves, and they will be looking to see the extent to which within Donald Trump's MAGA base there is solidity of opinion on this issue. I mean, there are many conspiracy theorists in Donald Trump's MAGA base who have asked questions about Epstein for a long time and who have been ignored by the media in this country, certainly by dominant publications in this country, because, oh, it's just a conspiracy theory. Well, now we discover that it not only was a conspiracy theory, but there was a tremendous failure of the American media to investigate this prior to the last presidential election. But is it doing anything to drive a wedge between Trump and his Make America Great Again supporters? That's going to end up being the absolutely key determinant in terms of where this story goes.
And do you think it will, briefly?
Well, I think for some, they will continue to adhere to the view that there's a massive White House cover-up taking place here, unless the White House can find a way of proving that there is not. And certainly everything that we've seen, going back to February, when Pam Bondi said she had the files on her desk, she was reviewing them and getting ready to release them, and then 3 months later, the Department of Justice suddenly says there are no files, they don't exist. I mean, all of that reeks of a cover-up. So I think there is a potential. I think he's got a problem. But also he's got a limitless capacity to distract in a post-truth environment in which those pliant polemicists of his at the White House are all telling their viewers, their readers and their listeners today, there's nothing to see here.
Pliant polemicists, what a lovely turn of phrase. And I don't know if I should ask you this question, but if you were a betting man, as things stand today, do you think the midterms will take place?
I think it depends entirely on how much difficulty he thinks Republican candidates are. I don't think he knows yet.
No, of course he doesn't.
I think once we get into the campaign, if Republicans look like they're heading for defeat in the House and the Senate, and the Democrats are going to take over, all bets will be off. Because remember, if the House and the Senate switch, and the Democrats particularly end up in control of the House of Representatives, they will have the power to launch impeachment proceedings against him. And that would tie him up in knots for a very long time, as we've already seen twice. The first term of his presidency. So I don't think he knows yet. I think he'll make that decision when he looks at the numbers.
No, of course, it's a stupid question, actually. We forgot about these people like him and like the one we're going to talk about next. They exist in a 24-hour cycle. How do I get past this problem? And then I'll deal with the next one, which is why we'll be talking about Boris Johnson after this.